Welcome to Our Voices, Our Future, the podcast where we amplify the voices driving change in equity within medicine and beyond. Brought to you by the Gender Equity Task Force, a committee of the American Medical Women's Association. We're here to challenge norms, break barriers, and ignite conversations that matter. I'm your host, Laura Uricochea, and in each episode, we bring you candid discussions with leaders, changemakers, and advocates committed to building a more inclusive and just world. No more silence, no more waiting. It's time to get our voices, our future. Today, we will be talking about women in medicine and leadership with a particular focus on the leaky pipeline. Why are women, especially those from underrepresented backgrounds, not making it to higher levels of leadership in medicine despite more women entering the field of medicine? To help us unpack this, I am honored to welcome Dr. Rosie Thatchell. Dr. Thatchell is a quadruple board-certified cardiologist and the director of the Cardiac Intensive Care Unit at Elmhurst Hospital Center. She serves on the American College of Cardiology Critical Care Leadership Council and is an assistant professor at Mount Sinai College of Medicine in New York. Currently, Dr. Thatchell is a candidate of the Wharton Executive MBA program at the University of Pennsylvania and holds certificates in physician leadership and bioethics. In addition to addressing cardiovascular disease, she is passionate about advancing women's roles in leadership in medicine and serves as a co-chair of AMWA's Gender Equity Task Force. Dr. Thatchell, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Laura. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Of course. Okay, so I wanted to begin with the basics. For our listeners who may not be familiar, can you explain what the leaky pipeline means in medicine and why it is a persistent issue?
Sure. So the leaky pipeline really refers to the steady attrition of women as they advance through the stages of a medical career, from medical school to training to early practice to then leadership positions. So while, as you alluded to before, women now make up more than half of medical school classes, we still see them underrepresented in positions of power, be it department chairs, deans, professorship, board members, managing their practices, so forth. And this isn't because of a lack of talent or ambition, but rather because of institutional or societal structures that weren't built with women in mind. And so this creates a quiet but constant push out over time.
Yeah, I actually spent some time reading the position paper you co-authored, A Commitment to Gender Equity in Medicine, an American Medical Women's Association position paper. And there was one statistic that stood out to me, which highlights the ongoing gender inequity in medicine. And this statistic states that despite women comprising roughly half of medical school graduates for several years, only 21% of all professors, 15% of department chairs, and 16% of deans are women physicians.
Yeah, those are sort of staggering statistics, right, for 2025. So, you know, all of these women are entering medical school, but then at some point we're losing them in that pipeline. And it's something certainly that we need to address as a medical community.
Right. And in your experience, where along the pipeline do you see the most significant drop-offs? Is it during training, early career, or when it comes to promotion into leadership roles?
Yeah, I think it's really all of the above. I will say the early career phase is particularly vulnerable because that's right when you have the demands of a new practice or a new job. You may also be possibly involved in childbearing or caretaking, and then you may have, you know, professional advancement collide with all of these other things. So it's the time we're expected to lean in the hardest, yet often without the support, the infrastructure, the mentorship to really support us in all areas of life. And then later on in the career, the drop-off is still there because at the leadership table where decision-making happens, there's still a representation. There's still a lack of representation, I should say. So it really is across the trajectory of the woman's career. But certainly I do feel that the early career phase is particularly vulnerable.
I agree with you. I think in early career, as a woman enters the field of practice, navigating different responsibilities that are additional to professional responsibilities, such as parenting and caregiving, can make juggling responsibilities much more difficult. And as you said, without the institutions and the people within them, without their support, we end up losing so many qualified women who could have filled leadership positions.
Absolutely. And sometimes we lose them to from medicine altogether as well.
Mm-hmm. I am aware that there are systemic biases also that play a role in this. So I wanted to ask you a question about this. How do systemic biases contribute to the leaky pipeline, and where do you see the most significant barriers?
Yeah, so I think systemic bias is often invisible, right? It shows up in who gets tapped for high impact projects, who gets recommended for awards, who is sort of seen as quote unquote leadership material. Oftentimes women are more likely to be over-mentored and under-sponsored. So lots of people to sort of give you advice, but not a ton of people putting your name in the ring, when there's an opportunity. So that's a challenge. There's also the double bind. So if we advocate for ourselves, we're seen as difficult. If we don't, we're overlooked. So it's truly a tough spot, a narrow window we're in. And these barriers are reinforced by metrics of success that don't account for structural inequality as well.
Yeah, I think it's overly complicated. And now that you mentioned that women are over-mentored and under-sponsored, would you mind talking a little bit more about this? I read an interview you did where you touched on this subject, but I would like you to expand on it so that our listeners can learn a little more about this.
Yeah, so, mentors are individuals who can give you advice, can serve as consultants, but sponsors are people who give you opportunities, right? Mm-hmm. So, sometimes mentors will tell you what to do, give you life advice based on their trajectory. But at the end of the day, advice is great, but opportunity is far better, right? So you need those people that say, hey, I'm going to put Laura's name in the ring for this opportunity. I'm going to nominate her for this council, this position, right? You need those people, not just mm-hmm. people who give you advice, but people who give you actionable items.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it opens a lot more doors if you have somebody who is willing to do that for you over just giving you advice for something.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you think the leaky pipeline affects certain racial or ethnic groups disproportionately?
I think so. I don't have data to specifically support this, but I think I can speak from my own experience here as a woman of color. I think the compounded effect of racism on top of sexism is very challenging to deal with. I think microaggressions, invisibility, exclusion from informal networks, professional and otherwise, these all take a toll over time. And I certainly think intersectionality is something we need to talk about more, particularly in healthcare and medicine.
And is this something that you're still experiencing to this day in your career?
I think in general, women, people of color, minority populations, we deal with this in medicine and healthcare. Mm-hmm. I think for me, I've built such great community that I am more resilient towards the microaggressions now, right? So I have communities of women, communities of women physicians that I can sort of lean on when those things do happen. Mm-hmm. But, these are systemic issues that we need to solve for over time.
And do you have any advice for our listeners who maybe haven't quite learned yet how not to let these microaggressions get to them?
Yeah, it's really hard, right? Because I think probably 5-10 years ago, I think I used to engage in sort of emotional hurt when microaggressions would happen, right? Whether it was sort of a subtly sexist remark, something like that. It would really bother me and I would sort of ruminate about it all day. I think over time, you develop your own way of managing it. And the way I always looked at it is if I dwell on the emotional hurt, it's time I'm taking away from my own career, Yeah. So that's one way to look at it. And the other thing that really helped for me is to just have a few friends, usually other female physicians, to just vent to about it, right? Because the truth is, it's actually not an isolated experience, right? Other women experience this too. So having that community is really, really helpful.
Oh yeah, I could see that. I could see if there are other women also experiencing the same thing, you can build a lot of strength from just sharing those experiences mm-hmm. amongst each other.
Absolutely.
How do you think these compounded inequities affect not just physicians themselves, but the broader healthcare system, from patient outcomes to innovation and research?
Yeah, so when we lose diverse voices in medicine, we lose innovation and we lose cultural competency. And patients do better with diverse teams, and they do better when they see themselves reflected in their providers, right? Research becomes more inclusive, policy becomes more human. Equity isn't just a moral imperative, but it's actually clinical excellence. So the system loses when it fails to nurture everyone's potential.
Yeah, and I feel like if the people making decisions or leading the departments, if they don't reflect the diversity of the patient population, there can be like a disconnect that can really affect outcomes.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the position paper, there was a strong call for institutional accountability and structured support, things like formal sponsorship programs, clear promotion criteria, mm-hmm. and leadership development tracks. Have you seen any successful initiatives or programs that have improved retention rates?
Yeah, so I think at the institutional levels, if you can have programs that, like you said, center mentorship and sponsorship, normalize flexibility, have diversity in the leadership, those can be really effective. Leadership development programs, for example, that are tailored for women physicians, have transparency in pay data, have dedicated support for caregiving. All of these things can have real impact. But the challenge, of course, is that many of these changes need to be systemic, not even just at the institutional level or even at the individual level. So there's a lot of work to be done here. Across the board.
Right. I think it's really unfortunate that there are so many of these systemic barriers. Like you said, transparency and pay structures, and there's also a lack of transparency and promotion procedures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And all of these can contribute to the leaky pipeline, and they keep gender inequity and leadership going.
Yeah.
If we don't address the leaky pipeline, or worse, if we keep normalizing it, what do you think the long-term consequences will be for the future?
So if we normalize inequity, we basically teach the next generation that bias is just part of the deal, right? That you just accept it. And perhaps even more importantly, we fail to deliver the kind of care our patients deserve, right? Mm-hmm. So if we don't fix the pipeline, we're not just losing talent, but we're also reinforcing a system that leaves too many people behind, physicians and patients. And I really believe the future of medicine should reflect the full richness of those who enter it.
And what do you think would be some good solutions to address this issue that we keep seeing for so many years?
Yeah, I think one we already mentioned, right? Sponsorship. Mm-hmm. I think that is so powerful. And your sponsor does not have to be a woman, right? It can be a male physician. It just needs to be somebody who opens doors for you. I think that's the most important thing. And the second thing that I think has been helpful for me, which I also kind of mentioned earlier, is community. Having strong community, right? Even if it's just a bounce an idea of, hey, should I take this position? What move should I make in my career? What should I do, you know, in my personal life? You know, I'm balancing, you know, maybe taking care of a child and working. So just having those communities where you can bounce ideas off without any judgment, those are really powerful.
Can you think of any ways that there could be structural changes at institutions? So how can we move those forward?
Yeah, I think certainly transparency, right? Like we were talking about academic promotions, for example, right? So even if academic institutions, hospital systems can be more transparent about promotions and really prioritizing women getting promoted, I think that can be really, really helpful and really effective.
What do you think it's going to take to get to a place where there's gender equity in medicine?
Continued advocacy and then speaking up, right? I think we have made progress. You look back 50, 60 years ago, right? There weren't many women in medical school, and now we have more than 50% of matriculants to medical school are women. So we have made progress. It's slow progress, but it is progress. So I think you just got to keep knocking on those doors.
Mm-hmm. I agree. What is one piece of advice? And I think we kind of already covered this, but what is one piece of advice that you would offer women navigating medicine today, especially those facing burnout or discouragement or disappointment?
I think you don't have to be everything to everyone. Advocate boldly for yourself and for other women, and then don't underestimate the power of community. You know, find your people, and when you're ready, use your voice, because someone else is waiting to hear that it's okay to speak up too.
I think what you just said is really powerful, and it actually reminded me of something else that I wanted to bring up. Something you said on another podcast you were a guest on, you talked about how learning to stop caring so much about what other people think really helped you in your career and in your life.
Absolutely. I think authenticity, right? Being your raw self is so powerful, right? Because a lot of times we're just so cautious about what other people will say about us. Even if you just have, let's say, an innovative idea, you're so scared to put it out there because you'll think, oh, people are going to think I'm crazy, right? but if you can just kind of move past that and be a little bit comfortable being uncomfortable, and be willing to take a little bit of risk, you know, obviously, you know, measured risk, I think that can be really powerful and just kind of unleash your authentic self instead of, you know, perhaps being perfectionist.
Right. I think it's just really, really hard to fight that imposter syndrome mm-hmm. that can just follow you everywhere throughout your career and your training.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know for me if that the imposter syndrome has like completely gone away. I think mm-hmm. it's just that I've become better at managing it.
Yeah. And I think that just comes with experience, right?
Yeah, I think it comes with experience. It comes with exposure. It comes with kind of putting yourself in uncomfortable situations and realizing that you're able to handle it. So it kind of builds your confidence over time.
Mm-hmm. And before we wrap up, I was just wondering if there's anything else that you would like to say to our listeners.
Well, I would say, you know, AMWA and the Gender Equity Task Force for me has been such a powerful community and tool, if you will, for many things, really to bounce ideas off of, to take on new initiatives, things of that nature. So certainly if there's anyone listening that, you know, this episode resonated with, I would, definitely recommend that you join the Gender Equity Task Force.
All right. Well, thank you so much again for being with us today. Well, I guess with me. And that's a wrap on this episode of Our Voices, Our Future. We hope today's conversation inspired you, challenged you, and reminded you of the power of raising your voice. The fight for equity doesn't stop here. Join us in the movement. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you loved this episode, share it with someone who needs to hear it. Until next time, stay bold, stay vocal, and keep the conversation going. This is Our Voices, Our Future.